The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Episode 7 of Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. I'm Nick McCarville in Charleston this week for the WTA event here. You might hear some tennis in the background of this recording, but it's been an active March in tennis, and we're moving towards the clay season, the spring season leading into the French Open. We're celebrating 50 years of the U.S. Open of open-era tennis, and I'm excited once again to bring you this podcast. We've got current, we've got past, and it's all interesting. We've got a little bit of luck for this episode as well. I spoke with John Isner in Miami midway through his tournament run, which ended up being the biggest tournament of his career. We're going to get to that audio in a few minutes, but we're continuing our celebration of the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Open by taking a stroll down memory lane with the person who holds a unique place in tennis history. Open tennis officially started, and I actually didn't know this until recently, but on April 22nd, 1968. It's a date that's, of course, just a couple weeks away, and the winner of the first match in the Open era, his name is Owen Davidson.
For guys of my age, Australian guys especially of my age, the thrill of walking into Bournemouth and knowing that Ken Rosewall and Rod Laver were going to be there was just something you couldn't have even imagined. And the biggest memory I have of it all to this day is walking into that club and seeing Pancho Gonzalez in the same locker room playing in the same tournament.
Well, Owen has led a fascinating tennis life, and Steve Flink recounts all of it in his visit with Owen Davidson. That's to come later in the episode. Now, I mentioned John Isner. We were lucky, fortuitous, to get the chance to sit down with him in Miami. I spoke with him after his win over Hyung Chung midway through the tournament. He then went on to win a couple more matches, including a dramatic final over Sasha Zverev to take the title. And it was fascinating and refreshing to see someone like John, and before him Juan Martín Del Potro in Indian Wells, win the biggest tournament of his career for Isner. He said, "Now I know what Roger Federer feels like every other week." The celebration, the candor from John, and really the hard work. He's 32 years young, and he wins the biggest title of his career. We talk about his age and where he is in this interview that's to come, but it was a busy March on the pro front. We saw the incredible run of Danielle Collins, both at Indian Wells and then even more so at Miami, beating her childhood hero in Venus Williams, making the Miami semifinals. They're both college, former college standout players, NCAA standout players. John Isner and Danielle Collins having fantastic marches. And then also to see the tennis say goodbye to Crandon Park. We saw the Bryan brothers win, Sloane Stephens, as well as John Isner, Coco Vandeweghe partnering with Ash Barty. So there was a lot to talk about from Miami. And then it was the great return of Serena Williams. She won a couple matches in Indian Wells. We got to see the Williams sisters play each other in Indian Wells, and Serena going down to Venus in Indian Wells and then losing to Naomi Osaka. But how wonderful is it to see Serena back on the tennis court? I would say very wonderful. So lots happening there. And we also have to say congratulations to the U.S. men's team. They're into the Davis Cup semifinals after a win over Belgium this past weekend. He was in action in Nashville, but more importantly, we got the chance to speak with John Isner midway through, as I mentioned, in Miami. Here's my chat with John Isner. So you had a little bit of a tough start to the year, but when things click well, they can certainly go your way. What's clicked about your game this week in Miami?
It's always been the case with me. If I'm not doing the right things on the court, I've shown that I can really lose to a lot of players. But if I am doing the right things and playing the right way and playing with confidence and patience on the court, that I can also be a very tough out, and I think I'm showing that this week. But most of that has come from finally putting together two matches in a row. I hadn't done that to this point. So I won my first two matches, and then every single match I've played, I've played better. And so I'm at a pretty good level right now.
Can I ask you, you know, when there's always going to be ebbs and flows, right? Mm-hmm. Even for, say, a Federer or a Rafa or whoever, but when things aren't going your way, how do you sort of manage that want to maybe change things up or kind of just stay the course and do the things you know you're good at?
Yeah, well, look, I knew I didn't need to change things up. I knew I was doing the right things. I just wasn't seeing the right results. So for me, I knew that it was all just between the ears, and it was something I needed to hash out with my coaches about what's been preventing me from playing my best tennis, what I'm feeling like in the big moments, and why I'm not really getting over the hump there. And so we've done that this week with my coach David, and it's helped a lot. You know, we've put perspective on things and just taking pressure off myself, because pressure is really the enemy. Of course, I mean, pressure is it's a privilege. You know, you want to be in these big moments, but if you let it get to you, you can't relax out on the court, and you can't play the right way.
How do you guys do that? I mean, you know, you've been at this for a long time, but how do you sort of confront those feelings or fears and then actually, John, apply it on the court?
No, it's a good question. It's, you know, it's as an athlete, you don't want to seem vulnerable, but sometimes it's good to really hash it all out. And there were some things preventing me from playing my best tennis this year, and that's, you know, I think just wanting to win so badly. I mean, that's a good thing, but it can overwhelm you at times. So when you lose, everyone says this, when you lose focus, when you lose sight of the process and you're just worried about the result, things aren't going to go your way. So I just stayed steady in what I'm doing, practicing and in the gym, and keep myself healthy. That's all the stuff I can control. And I also can control, you know, my mindset on the court as best as I can. So that's what I've done this week, and it's certainly helped out.
Do you go back and watch wins or losses, or try to look at certain moments and how you handle them?
A little bit, but that's what my coaches are for as well. They pull up those moments, and you know, it could be 5 years ago when a big point, a huge point or a huge match that I've played and I played well and came through in the clutch. You know, just try to recreate those feelings. It's very important.
You're going to be, what, 33 here in a few weeks?
Yeah.
John, I'm not behind you. We talked a couple years ago in Rome about you felt like your best tennis was still in front of you. Do you still feel that way? And if so, why?
I do. Look, as long as I'm feeling healthy and fit, you know, and look, there were some times earlier this year where I'd certainly doubted that for sure, because I wasn't playing well, I wasn't moving well, but movement, especially with me, that comes from confidence. If I'm confident on the court, I feel like I'm moving as well as I ever have. So, look, as long as I stay healthy, and I do think some of my best tennis is ahead of me. Look, I just played a very, very good match just now at almost 33 years old. So, like, I want to keep doing this as long as I can.
You're married in December. Congratulations,
Thank you.
By the way, to Maddie, who you've been with for a long time.
Yes.
Has that changed life on court at all, or that was more of a formality off of it?
It hasn't really changed too many things. We've been together for a very long time, but now we finally tied the knot, getting married. So I guess the only difference is I got this wedding band on, and I don't ever take it off. I play with it on, which I think is cool and pretty unique. And so we're very happy with where we are in our lives, and so life is good for me.
Do you notice it on court ever? I mean, are there moments of...
No, not really. That's why I have it on, because I don't notice it. It doesn't catch or move or anything like that, so it's fine.
I know that you're a guy that, you know, for a long time, or for always, I guess, you've liked to play in the States. And I think when American tennis fans think of American tennis, it's the summer. But this swing of New York and Delray Beach, Indian Wells, Miami, Houston, there's a lot of you guys playing in Nashville for Davis Cup. What's this part of the season do for you, maybe mentally or emotionally, as well as for your tennis?
Yeah, it does a lot for me. It's a part time of the year where a lot of things favor me, and conditions, and I'm not traveling. There's never any time change. I'm like, look, there's 3-hour time change in California, but for tennis players, that's absolutely nothing. So it's a good part of the year, the time of the year for me to play well, and as long as I just stay focused and do the right things, I have played extremely well during this stretch. And it's not over after this tournament. As you mentioned, we are going to Nashville, and I'm again going to play Houston. I absolutely love that tournament. And then I'll take a little time off. Stevie Johnson's getting married, and I'll be in his wedding. So a couple of fun weeks ahead of me for sure. I just want to cherish these moments.
You mentioned Steve Johnson, him and Sam Querrey still alive in the doubles. You and Jack Sock winning doubles in Indian Wells.
Yeah.
Ryan Harrison winning doubles last year at the French Open. Donald Young's played well. I mean, obviously we think of Bob and Mike as the doubles team, but what is it about the U.S. men being able to sort of switch over and play such good doubles too?
I think we just all just have fun playing with each other, and we're all relaxed, and we definitely don't put any pressure on ourselves, and that helps. You know, sometimes when you're playing against doubles guys only, you know, they're out there, they're tight, we're just goofing around and having a good time. That it helps on the doubles court. So we do have a lot of talented doubles players, especially for our Davis Cup team now as well. And I think Jack, in my opinion, is the best doubles player in the world. I don't think there's can be any argument there.
Why is that?
He's just, his second ball is so good, and he's so quick, and he's I don't know, just not used to seeing someone that athletic on the doubles court. He's very, very good.
Lastly, for you, I know that the U.S. Open is special to every American tennis player, but when you think of that tournament, just what sort of comes to mind? I know that you've had some big wins and disappointing losses, but what is special about that event that sort of pops to mind?
Well, I think it's just the crowd support that Americans get there. It's very special, and it's one of the four biggest tournaments, four biggest events we have in this game. And so as an American to be able to every year suit up and take those courts, it's very, very special to have that crowd behind you. And you want to have those moments where the crowd's erupting and you're playing well, and you walk off the court victorious. It's very, very special. It's a little more special winning matches there than it is in any other slam, I think.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, best of luck. Keep the streak going, and we appreciate the time.
All right, thanks, Nick.
Okay, once again, thanks to John Isner, and thanks to the tennis gods for setting that up, because we did not know, nor did we plan for him to win the tournament, but he did, and kudos to him. The biggest day of his life, he said, after that victory. All right, Owen Davidson won all four majors in 1967 in mixed doubles, one of only two men to hold that distinction. If that wasn't enough to solidify his place in tennis history, 1 year later, he stepped onto the court and won not just any match, the very first match of the Open era. Let's take you back to April 22nd, 1968, in rainy England. Here's Steve Flink with Owen Davidson.
We're very happy on this podcast to welcome Owen Davidson, the Hall of Famer from Australia, who won the Mixed Doubles Grand Slam in 1967, winning it with Billie Jean King after having played the first of those events with Leslie Turner. But Owen, one of your greatest claims to fame, and something I know you're very proud of, is you played in the very first match ever of the Open era, April 22, 1968, at the British Hard Court Championships in Bournemouth. Can you explain the circumstances behind that, how you came to play the first match ever in the Open era?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of circumstances actually behind it. I'd been talking to the All England Club for a while, and after I got to the semifinals at Wimbledon in 66, they interviewed me about the job at the Organ Club.
Right.
And I was talking to Mr. Herman David and to Major David Mills. And then after I decided I was going to turn pro and be the Organ Club professional, which was a big decision in those days. So after I won Wimbledon in 67, I think Lee and I won the mixed, I kind of turned around on the center court and looked at a little bit of grass and figured that would be the last time I'd ever be back there. I went to Britain and became the Organ Club coach. I guess it was about October or November of 67, which was a huge decision, because that was the end of tennis as far as I was concerned, amateur tennis. And we used to do, in those days, Steve, we used to do the winter training, as you well know, because you remember, at Queen's Club.
Yes, I was.
We did all our winter training at Queen's Club in those days. And in the middle of winter, I obviously spent a lot of time talking to Major Mills and Mr. Herman David, because I actually worked for them. By then, I worked for them. In those days, the All England Club player at Wimbledon was employed by Wimbledon, and then you were contracted out to the LTA. And I came out of the indoor courts one day in November, October, and Mr. David, there was a lot of people there, a huge number of people there, had been at the LTA meeting. And Herman walked up to me and he said, "Oh, I just want you to know that no matter what happens, We're going open next year. We just made a decision and we're going open next year, which once again, I didn't think it would affect me a whole lot, although now, of course, I realize how much it affected me. And so anyway, so the first tournament, as you said, was Bournemouth, and I asked the LTA if I had permission to play because I had to ask them, and they said, absolutely no problem, of course you can play. So I entered Bournemouth, and then the interesting thing on the day, for those that have never been to Bournemouth, which I'm sure is probably a lot of people, there was a clubhouse court right up where the clubhouse was, and then the centre court is kind of like the situation at Forest Hills these days. Centre court was like 500 yards all the way down the walkway where you had to walk before you got to the centre court. And on centre court was scheduled Fred Stolle and a guy by the name of Peter Curtis, who was on the British Davis Cup team.
Yep, remember him well. He ended up marrying Marianne Eisel, is that correct?
He did, yep. He did, amongst others. And I was scheduled to play John Clifton, who was also on the Davis Cup team, on the grandstand court. And as it turned out, it rained like it always did at Bournemouth. The clubhouse court dried way, way quicker than the centre court. Consequently, John Clifton and I went on a long time before the centre court was ready and played the first match in open tennis, yeah.
And Owen, were you aware of the significance of that? I mean, it was a big deal. Obviously, Herman David had told you of his and what was going to unfold, but nevertheless, this was a big moment. And did it dawn on you at that point of where this was all going and how important it all was, and that you were being such a part of it and playing in the first match?
No idea. Just went on the court because he had to go on the clubhouse court to play John. No, totally, totally, totally unaware.
And did you feel a lot of pressure playing John and being the pro, and here were the pros and amateurs playing in the same tournaments for the first time? That must have been something of a burden, or was it not?
If I'd have been in competition still, playing John Clifton, a great guy, we would have probably considered it not too difficult a match. But having been the pro for 5 or 6 months by then, you know, you don't play matches, you're just practicing with the team. The whole idea was practicing was to make them better, not you. So, yeah, so then there was a bit of pressure because now all of a sudden the pupil had the chance to beat the teacher.
So then, Owen, you went on to the quarters and lost to Rosewall. And do you remember the atmosphere as that tournament unfolded and eventually ended up with Rosewall beating Labor in the finals? How everybody felt about this inaugural event taking place when it did?
Somebody asked me that the other day, and I had no idea who I'd lost to. None. But then they mentioned to me that I'd lost to Rosewall in the quarters. I do very well remember watching the final between Ken and Rod, and it was the usual Labor-Rosewall match, and it was a great match to watch, and everybody loved it. But, you know, honestly, I think anybody that told you then that they knew where all this was going, I think they'd be lying.
Interesting.
I don't think anyone, even Labor and Rosewall, as much as they knew that it was great and they were in the first open final, I don't think any of us really knew where it was all going to go. For guys of my age, Australian guys especially of my age, the thrill of walking into Bournemouth and knowing that Ken Rosewall and Rod Laver were going to be there was just something you couldn't have even imagined. But the biggest memory I have of it all, because Rod and Ken were friends, still are friends, and played against them many, 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 many times, and the biggest memory I have of it all to this day is walking into that club and seeing Pancho Gonzalez in the same locker room playing in the same tournament. Deep down, you always had a feeling, as an Australian guy like Newcomb and Roach and myself, probably Stolle, somewhere along the line you may see Rod and Ken and those guys again on the other side of a net. But to see the image of Pancho Gonzalez, that was something I'll never forget. And even now, when I think of Bournemouth, I think of playing John Clifton, obviously, walking onto that court. And I think, you know, obviously Rod and Kent playing the final, et cetera, et cetera. But the memory still floods into my head of seeing Pancho Gonzalez at the same event we were playing at. It was pretty amazing.
Owen, do you have any recollection of what you made? I think that Kenny might have made £1,000 for winning it. What did you make from reaching the quarters?
Not a clue, Steve. Not any idea. I mean, it's amazing. No idea.
That's interesting. Now, Owen.
It's better than I'd made before. I knew that.
Yeah, of course. Let's go back to the year before briefly and talk about, what did you set out in 67? It started with Leslie Turner, and then you won the last three with Billie Jean, and you're one of, there have only been two mixed doubles Grand Slams because Ken Fletcher won it with right. Margaret Smith. But right. Was that something that unfolded, or was it something that you as an outstanding doubles player thought that you could accomplish when the year began?
Once again, Steve, in those days, we didn't count all the statistics like they do these days. And I just happened to play mixed with Leslie in Australia, and we won. And there was a lot of circumstances around me getting together with Billie Jean in Paris, and we won. And then we decided to play Wimbledon, and we won. And then we played together in the U.S. Open, or the whatever it was called in those days.
Right.
And once again, Steve, I had no idea that I was playing for the Grand Slam. It was the late Bud Collins.
Right, right.
Who lived in Boston in those days, as you know, mm-hmm. came up to me before that match, and I think we played Smith and Casals.
Yes, you did.
I'm not positive.
You did.
Okay.
You did.
And he came up to me and he said, you know, you realize, Davo, that you've got a chance of winning the Grand Slam. Billie Jean does not. But you do, and I, you know, to be honest with you, that was the very, very first time I even thought about it.
So he Bud said that to you before the finals, or?
Yeah, before. That was very nice of him, wasn't it? Scared the hell out of me.
I was going to say you were much better off not hearing. But it's interesting, Owen. I looked back and I see that you had good wins in the finals of all those majors. Beat Judy with Leslie. You beat Judy Tegart and Tony Roach.
Right.
Then you went over Ann Haydon Jones and Jan Tyriak at the French, and you beat Maria Bueno and Ken Fletcher at Wimbledon. Right. And finally, as you said, Rosie and Stan at the U.S. Those are all pretty distinguished teams. I mean, did you feel like there were more people taking the mix seriously at that time? As you look back, those were very good wins.
Well, Steve, of all people, you would know, and Billie Jean and I talk about it often. She brings it up often. Because we still talk quite a lot. In those days, almost everybody played every event. So if you look back at the Wimbledon results earlier than that, you'll find Rod Laver won the Wimbledon mixed. You'll find Fred Stolle won it many times. You'll find all the great players play it. And when Billie Jean, I mean, the toughest team by far for us, Billie Jean and I, to play was Margaret Smith Court and Marty Reeson. And everybody, the word definitely, some easy first rounds because there wasn't a depth in tennis that there is these days. But once you got through to the quarters, you know, you were playing teams like, as you say, Francois Durr and Tony Roach, or Olga Morozova and Alex Metrovelli, who lost in the final at Wimbledon. One of the years Billy and I won, we played Kotas and Navratilova in the quarterfinals. Mm. Navratilova was very young then. But, I mean, yeah, we played a lot of... Not early in the tournament. Early in the tournament, mostly the matches were not so difficult. You're right.
Oh, and did it sink into you? Bud, of course, had put that thought in your head before the finals against Rosie and Stan. Then you go out, win the title comfortably, and now you've pulled off all four for a Grand Slam. At that point, did it sink into you in a more substantial way?
Well, I'm almost sure that Bud probably said something afterwards, and I obviously thought about it. It wasn't like I didn't. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. I want, you know, the Grand Slam because, I mean, yeah, I obviously gave it some thought and thought how good it was and very pleased and all that sort of stuff. And then went on to whatever was the next tournament. And I'm not belittling it at all. It's just the way we were in those days. It wasn't that long after that. One friend of mine said to me, I saw your name in the Guinness Book of Records. And I said, the Guinness Book of Records? What are you talking about? And that's when they told me, and I think it's still there, was that the first match in open tennis against John Clifton and then winning the Grand Slam in mixed doubles. Apparently they had it in the Guinness Book of Records, yeah.
Well, that's interesting, Owen, because I think that you'd probably agree there were a lot of things that brought you into the International Tennis Hall of Fame, but probably that Grand Slam triumph of 67 in the mix was one of the main reasons why. Would you agree?
All the doubles titles.
Right, right.
I would agree completely. And, you know, Billie Jean always used to say, we all knew that there wasn't a depth in tennis in those days that there is today. But Billie always used to say to me, Owen, you can only play who they put out in front of you. Whether the name's Rod Laver, whatever. You can only play the two they put in front of you.
Yeah, absolutely. She's right.
And she's right. She's right.
No, and you it, just briefly, and in your the singles highlight for you, and I was there at the match. You got to the semis of Wimbledon, made spectacular comeback against Manolo Santana in 66 Wimbledon, which of course he ended up winning over Dennis Ralston. What are your reflections on that match? That was a great moment for you, and you so very nearly made the finals in singles.
That was definitely my greatest singles moment, and that started having played so well in that match and nearly having won, and the sportsmanship in that particular match between Santana and I was such, that's what started off the All England club negotiating with me to be the head pro, to be the coach, because they all saw that match. We obviously got a lot of commendations for the way we both behaved in that match and our attitudes and our friendship. And apart from the tennis result, the sportsmanship that the All England club considered important, it probably got me the job. I would never talk about that match without saying that, with all due respect, by far the number one amateur in the world, by far at that stage, was Roy Emerson. And as you know,
yes,
he was killing me in the quarterfinals. When he ran into the umpire's chair, slipped and ran into the umpire's chair, hurt his shoulder badly, got up, never complained, finished the match, didn't stop. You know, without that unfortunate incident, I would never have got myself into that match with Santana.
Well, that's fair enough, Rowan. Owen, I understand what you're saying, and it was a sad moment for Roy, but you did play brilliantly against Santana, and I know
probably the best singles match ever played, yes.
Yeah. Now, Owen, let's go forward a few years into the Open era as it began to unfold, and you were out there and achieving great things in doubles. And when it came to the U.S. Open, and of course we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Open this year, you had a tremendous moment in 1973 when you joined forces with your friend John Newcomb, and you beat the legendary Laver and Rosewall in the final. How gratifying was that victory as you look back on your career highlights, especially after you had been thinking back to the previous year in the finals with Newcomb when you lost to Drysdale and Taylor?
Yeah, which was a terrible loss. It's amazing because you're hitting on all the high points. When anybody ever asks me about the high points, and they do quite a lot now as I'm getting older, we're all getting older, and of course the matches with Billie Jean and 15-13 in the third against Court and Reeson and all that sort of stuff in the Wimbledon final. But it's hard to explain to people how the feeling was of two boyhood friends, kids, 14 and 15 years of age, and all of a sudden here we were standing under that canopy at Forest Hills about to play two of the greatest legends and two of the people that we idolized since we were 14 to 13, and to be able to have a chance to even go on the court with those two guys was unbelievable. Now, Newcomb in his own right, of course, by then was pretty good.
Yeah.
He may have even been, you know, I don't think he was number one, but he was up around that area. Was never lacking in confidence, as you know.
Yep.
And
that was one of his greatest traits.
Well, his confidence and his tennis mind, yeah. And to be standing there and then to go out in front of a full crowd, as it was on that day at Forest Hills, and play Laver and Rosewall was probably the greatest moment. When I think through it all, Billie Jean's obviously were great, and as you say, the first Open tennis was something that you're going to be remembered for. The Grand Slam, obviously, also, but that was something special. Just to think that he was in Sydney hitting on the garage wall, imagining he was playing Laver, and I was in Melbourne hitting on my garage wall when I was 13, 14, imagining I was playing Rosewall, and then to play the two of them in the final of the U.S. Open was really, really special, yeah.
Now, obviously, you were playing for an American audience, Owen, at Forest Hills. I mean, and they're watching four Australians. But I think the crowd was very appreciative of what they saw that day. What do you remember about how they responded to your triumph?
Once again, doubles was considered different in those days, as you know, than it is today. And it was a packed crowd and incredibly enthusiastic. And I'll never forget, there was always a possibility, and I was aware of this, the other three players on the court thought there was a chance that I would crack, and I thought there was a chance that I would crack. And to look up into the stands and, as you say, see the American crowd and so enthusiastic, and being able to win that match with Nuke was pretty special, yeah.
Now, Owen, you were able to play at Forest Hills in the amateur days as well, and then obviously in the early Open era. How do you look at that venue as someone who competed at all the majors and succeeded at all the majors? What were your impressions of Forest Hills, in, both in the amateur era and in the early Open era?
I go back to Forest Hills from time to time, even now, to do corporate events, and it's when you look at it, and then you look at where tennis is now, I mean, you just can't even imagine that we played the U.S. Open there, or U.S. Nationals, whatever you want to call it there. And at the time, we just thought it was unbelievable experience, and playing at that club and all the old lockers and the old... I mean, everything's pretty much the same.
Yeah.
And when you look at it and think, my God, we played that. And where people used to park, and I mean, it was incredible how different it is today as it was then. And yet, when you go there and you do these corporate events and you go down on the courts and you look back at that clubhouse, it brings back a lot of great memories, yeah.
The Open left Forest Hills in 78 for Flushing Meadows. It was a pretty dramatic change from this private club to a public facility to a much bigger stadium that eventually became even larger. How did you view that change in terms of what it meant to this country having a major sporting event that seemed to transcend tennis?
You had the same feeling when you did it. Okay, it's moved from Forest Hills. It had to move from Forest Hills. And it's hard to say we visualized what it was going to be now as this massive Billie Jean King, Arthur Ashe, New York happening. Massive in New York City for those 2 weeks.
Of course, in 2006, then they did, as you alluded to, really, they named the entire facility after Billie Jean after having named the stadium after Arthur in 97. And you know Billie Jean very well from all of your great mixed doubles triumphs and your lifelong friendship. How did you feel about that, the way things evolved and the naming after her and what she's meant to the game, especially given your relationship with her?
As a matter of fact, about 20 minutes before we did this interview, I was talking to her. Nothing to do with this interview. We remain friends and we still talk a lot, and we're both getting older now, and she never ceases to remind me of that. But obviously we knew Arthur well. I never really thought that they would name it after Billie Jean. And when they did, she has meant so much, not just to women's tennis, but to women generally in all facets of life. I mean, even to see her now when she's dealing with the things she has to deal with on a large scale, it's still very interesting to see her with a young player, you know, and how excited she gets about a young player that she thinks has some potential to do well, or even a young player that she knows well will not do great, but it's just a nice person. She takes them under her wing, and I can't say enough about her. She's been a good friend. She still is a good friend, and I hope it'll always be called the Billie Jean King Tennis Center. No one deserves it more.
Now, Owen, We already spoke about that, the Grand Slam and winning three with Billie Jean. You played a lot with her even beyond that, and, you know, and won a bunch more majors. And then you would go to Dallas. You'd play that mixed doubles event in Dallas, which had the great fields. And you had a lot of success with Billie Jean.
Yeah, you talk about pressure. That was pressure. That was pressure because I think it was just after she played Riggs, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, it was.
She was now even bigger Billie Jean King than she was before. And then all these great players, I can't remember all the great players that were there, but I know Laver was there and Emerson was there. And now I really felt pressure. I think we had I can't remember all the details, but I think we had a couple of really close matches.
Yeah, no, there were some great matches in those years, but that was a great showcase for the mixed. And
oh, it was unbelievable. Now, the final, I remember playing Rosie and Marty. You know, whenever we play against Rosie, you could always feel the confidence, i.e. with Billy, playing against Rosie. You know, they were best friends and doubles partners, just like I was best friends and doubles partner with Newcomb. But Newcomb always felt like he was going to beat me in singles. Unfortunately, he did. but I always felt like Billie Jean, we were going to beat Rosie. I don't know why, but I did. It was like she exuded it. I always felt like Billie Jean was going to pull it out again, and she did.
Now, Owen, you've had this remarkable history in the game as a player and a coach. What beyond the achievements that we've spoken of, I mean, what how do you view what you've done in the game. What has meant the most to you outside of the playing days? Because obviously you had that role as a national coach in the All England Club in Great Britain, and you've done some enterprises with John Newcombe at his ranch and many other endeavors too. What has meant the most to you on the coaching side?
Well, as you say, I coached a lot of players too, including Billie Jean, and I also coached the great player who's become a different person that you know well, Andrea Jaeger.
Yes.
She was a great, great player. I coached a lot of other players too. There's very little in tennis that I haven't been lucky enough to be part of. I even coached you, Steve.
You did. And Owen, I can only say that that was one of your few failures in life. But you did your best, and that was great. I was at the Queen's Club in 1968. My father had spoken to you, and you were kind enough to give me those lessons, and I'll never forget them. However, I knew.
Didn't we do one of the lessons once on that center court at Queen's?
We did.
That's what I thought.
And I remember at the end of it when your friend Tony Roach came out on the court, and I put my watch by the side of the court, and he thought I was going to step on it. But you were very kind to do that, Owen.
Oh, that's funny. I remember your dad well, and that time in London. Times were different then, but if I knew what was going to happen, not just in open tennis, but in British tennis, I probably would never have left the All England Club.
No, I can understand that, why you would say that retrospectively. I can easily understand.
Yeah, because in those days, there was no money there. I could make more money by playing for 3 months on the tennis circuit than I could make working at the All England Club for 9 months.
Mm. Oh, and let's go back one more time to that first match, the Clifton match. And now that
you, okay.
I only say that because we're coming up on the anniversary on April the 22nd. It'll be 50 years. So when you look at it from this vantage point, rather than how you felt at the time, does it become any more special to you thinking of that anniversary date and that you had the special niche in, of having been involved in that first match and not only having been involved in it, but fortunately to have won it?
I got to tell you, Steve, last year at Wimbledon, somebody came up to me, I won't say who, and said, look, it's the 50th year. We're thinking about doing a big celebration at Bournemouth. Would you come back? I said, are you kidding? I'd be back in a second. To be honest with you, I think it all fell through. I haven't heard another word since. But I do look back at it often. And I think, my God, it's April, and people are talking to me about it a little bit, just like you. And I never thought, I said to Billie Jean yesterday, I think it was, we were talking about some other stuff. Actually, we were talking about Elton John, actually, because I got tickets to go and see Elton John in December.
Yeah.
And she was saying, you know, and I said, Billy, it's hard to believe, but since that Open Tennis Day in 1968, it's 50 years. I mean, it's just incredible where it's all gone.
No, and it tied into that. How well do you remember that pro event that Herman David staged at the All England Club in the summer of 67? Labor and Rosewall, once again, the keynote performers. But do you remember what the sense among the players that this was really, that it, open tennis really was around the corner?
Oh, my God, I'll never forget it. The late Lou Hoad, as you well know, we all idolized him, and we all looked up to him. And to think that Mr. David, Herman David, said to the guys, look, I'm going to invite all you guys to Wimbledon in 1967. I guess it was August. You're right.
Right.
And I also was told, and I know this is true either, that it was one of the first ever color televised tennis tournaments. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. That is correct.
And apparently Mr. David said to the guys, look, if you make a success out of this, if we make a success out of this, I promise you, you'll be back playing at Wimbledon next year. And he was good to his word.
Well, Owen, this has been terrific. I've enjoyed it immensely. It's so nice to reminisce and catch up with you. And I certainly hope we will see you at the Open this year and that we'll cross paths once again.
Well, I hope so. And congratulations to you. I must be honest with you, I never thought that I would see the day after hitting with you on the center court at Queen's Club that I would be sitting next to you as you were being inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame last year. And I know you must have been very, very proud. And it was nice to have your buddy Chrissy Everett introduce you.
Well, you're so nice to bring that up, Owen. It was great to see you sitting back there. And on that hot, balmy day in Newport, and I'm delighted to join your club because we've got to make sure the listeners understand that you are an International Tennis Hall of Fame inductee as well. It was great seeing you there last summer, and Owen, it's been a joy for me to have this discussion with you today, and I hope we catch up again soon.
All right, Steve. Thanks, mate.
Bye now.
No one can quite tell stories like Australians can, and what an incredible experience to hear Owen Davidson tell those stories. To Steve Flink, a huge thanks to Owen for taking his time, as well as to John Isner for speaking with me midway through his Miami run. And again, as always, thanks to Steve Flink, a Hall of Famer himself, for being a part of this podcast. This has been Episode 7 of Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. You can find us on Audio Boom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much anywhere there's a podcast, that's where you're going to find Courtside. Thanks for listening. As usual, we'll be back in a couple weeks' time with more great content as we celebrate 50 years of open-air tennis. I'm Nick McCarville, and we'll talk to you again soon.